Well, with the unceasing defense of President Trump and failure to defend U.S. diplomats, to what extent has Secretary of State Mike Pompeo alienated his own diplomats? And if so, how would that potentially complicate America's relationship with the world? And then we have the U.S. presidential race and the power of incumbency, even for one Donald Trump. What about the Israeli party's failure to hammer together any kind of a government? And Turkey and Syria stabilized for now? Middle East expert Aaron David Miller, secretaries of state of both political parties, senior fellow, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Thank you, Aaron. And first of all, on Mike Pompeo, how would you characterize his position?
You know, Alan, I voted for Republicans and Democrats and worked for them as well. Yes. I've really never seen a situation quite like this. In December of 1985, in response to an executive order by the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, George Shultz publicly threatened to resign within a day because he refused to take a polygraph and refused to agree to a policy which would have subjected the 4,500 State Department employees and over 180,000 government employees to mandatory polygraphs. The Reagan administration retracted its policy on polygraphs. That was a Secretary of State, Republican, who was prepared to stand up, not just in defense of his own employees and his own department, but for rationality and credibility in governance. That's not what's happening here. This is the most politicized Secretary of State in the modern history of the United States. And he's either acquiescing, enabling, or even validating what I believe to be a deep abuse of the system. Whether or not what the president has done is impeachable, frankly, that's not my concern right now. It's the corruption of the system. It's the abuse of power. And it's the impact that it has on American policy abroad. I don't think, frankly, that this will pass. I think the State Department may well take a decade to recover from the last several years. But it, too, I suspect over time, with a different Secretary of State, a different president, will be able to resume the role that it plays. And let's be clear, the State Department has been minimized in importance over the past 20 years. This what's happening now is unprecedented, but the NSC, the Pentagon, controlling presidents have diminished the role of the Department of State. And while the president makes foreign policy, and he is the commander-in-chief, a good Secretary of State will be willing and able to stand up and provide the president with really wise counsel. That's not happening, no.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, we can go back several decades, Nixon and his national security advisor, where the Secretary of State was marginalized. In that sense, it isn't new, is it?
No, but it's Pompeo is not marginalized. Pompeo is simply acquiescing.
Yes.
In a system that is essentially substituting the president's personal and political interests for the national interest.
Well, could you not argue he's acquiescing because he was an ultra-conservative congressman and reflecting the parts of America that voted enthusiastically, avidly for President Trump and still appear to support President Trump, especially if Pompeo intends to go back and run for something? It would be a political millstone around his neck if he did adamantly defend the president.
Then frankly, he ought to resign.
Yeah.
Because the reality is there is something in my naive and, obtuse nature, even discounting all of that, there is something called the national interest. And the president of the United States is supposed to further that. It's hard for me to see how many of the decisions that this president has taken and this Secretary of State have acquiesced in basically are in the national interest, aside from all this shenanigans and abuse of power, and I don't want to trivialize it, that seems to be taking place with respect to his relationship with President Zelensky and Ukraine.
Well, I got to say, I mean, look at Secretary of State Tillerson. He was pilloried for other reasons, and some people thought that potentially Pompeo would be a breath of fresh air, and he appeared to signal that at the beginning.
Well, Pompeo learned the lessons of Rex Tillerson. Tillerson was the shortest tenured Secretary of State in the modern period. He was probably ill-suited and ill-equipped for the job, even though I think he's a decent human being. But what he learned was that you know, you can only say no to a president so many times. And with respect to Donald Trump, whether it was withdrawal from the Iranian nuclear agreement, a flawed but still functional accord, whether it was withdrawal from Paris climate, whether it was the way we've acquiesced, placated Saudi Arabia. I mean, all of these policies, it seems to me, undermined what I think the president of the United States ought to be focused on, which is the national interest. And by the way, politics always intrudes in foreign policy, but never through seven administrations have I seen a situation in which politics and the personal sensibilities of a president, biases, prejudices, likes and dislikes,
yeah,
essentially fundamentally directs and drives what should be the quote-unquote national interest of the United States.
Well, you mentioned how politics, to some extent, always intrudes. Christian Science Monitor has an article online about previous examples, maybe not as egregious, but where there did appear to be politics intruding, or even someone representing America who is not in any way employed by the United States of America, like in this case, Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, well, that's a whole separate matter and flows from the notion that there is or should be a process and a respect for a system that people think before they act. And they're not contracting out to individual consiglieres or personal attorneys their trust and fiduciary responsibility to safeguard the interests of the United States. And I think with respect to Ukraine, that's, you know, it's a classic example. I mean, I frankly, you know, Vladimir Putin, by virtue of Russia's privileged position in Ukraine's history, its proximity, and its own national interest, is going to prove dominant in that country. We've somehow decided that Ukraine is somehow to be the focus of Western civilization and is worth defending. I mean, I think that it may well be a highly questionable assumption, given the dysfunctional nature of its own system and the corruption that exists there. But the reality is this president has decided against what I think all logic and rationale to conflate his own personal interests and political interests, yeah, with those of the United States.
For people joining us, we're talking to Middle East expert Aaron David Miller, former advisor to secretaries of state of both political parties on Middle East negotiations, now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in the nation's capital. Let's go to, I think you would agree with me that as important as these issues are, it's not as though average Americans or even in the presidential debates will we hear very much about the Secretary of State not backing up his own diplomats. It might come up in more general terms, but that per se is not going to be what average people are talking about. But it does expose how an incumbent president, even this one, has formidable advantages running for re-election. Jimmy Carter accepted before, and the first President Bush accepted, I guess. But they had advantages, too, which didn't work out for them.
You know, but here we have an interesting piece of presidential trivia, which is not so trivial. I had a piece up on CNN.com, you can find it, called The Power of the Incumbency, in which I argue that for the first time since Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, let me repeat that, for the first time since Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, we've now had three two-term presidents in a row. It's extraordinary. And what it says to me, it says two things. Number one, it says that the power of the incumbent is enormous, truly enormous, and that it may well be that Americans are very forgiving, forgetful, and willing, essentially, and this is legitimate, to condition their own vote or non-vote based on their own particular circumstances and how they judge their own personal finances, state of mind when it comes to the country, and the presidency. And those two factors would suggest that it's conceivable you're going to have a fourth two-term president.
Although I would add the caveat that it's also more than conceivable that the Democratic nominee, whomever that person is, could even win more of the popular vote and still lose the election to the incumbent.
Yes, and there's no question that there's a structural advantage that accrues to the Democratic Party when electoral votes are inefficiently distributed with respect to the urban-rural divide that seems to give an advantage to those red states and those previously red states in the last election like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, those states that are critically important. Now, how that comes out, I don't know. The one factor that would work against the reelection of Donald Trump and four two-term presidents in a row, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, ... is the fact that as our politics melt down on the local level, and as Americans become more partisan, even tribal, in their political allegiances, the one office that retains a certain measure of respect and integrity is the presidency. And it may well be that if enough Americans believe that their current incumbent has so degraded and undermined the norms and conventions and the integrity of the office, could swing enough votes the other way.
Yeah.
But again, you can't beat something with nothing. You combine that with the inefficiency of the Electoral College and the way it's skewed and distributed across small and larger states. There's no guarantee, frankly, much of anything right now as we look toward 2020.
I want to get to Israeli politics in just a moment at the close. But quickly, do you think Michael Bloomberg's entry into the race, if that's what's going to happen, is going to further fragment the Democratic Party or not amount to much or amount to a lot?
You know, I don't believe in transformations, nor do I believe in the certain prospects of a candidate somehow as a redemptive or saving force. That is to say, someone who enters the race at this late stage. And remember, there's only one example of a presidential of a candidate who lost in both Iowa and New Hampshire. And
Bill
then
Clinton.
Went on to win the presidency, and that's Bill Clinton. So this is an upending of the conventional rules. I think what it reflects is the real trepidation on the part of the Democratic Party that they have a viable candidate that's capable of doing battle and then overcoming Donald Trump at the polls in November.
Yeah, quickly, Israel, still unresolved, right?
Yeah, another week or so, Benny Gantz, the head of the opposition, at least until now, the Blue and White Party, has another week or so to try to form a government. He probably will not succeed, though it's not certain. Then Israel will have another 21 days in which the president of the country will basically offer any member of Knesset the opportunity to put together a government composing 61 seats. If that fails after 21 days, you're going to elections the third time in what would be probably February, likely March. It shows that one of the most functional states in the Middle East, Israel, increasingly has its own share and percentage of dysfunctional politics.
And, of course, Turkish president over here, Turkey and Syria, stabilized or not?
I mean, I think you may. There's one huge piece of this is yet that, and that is Idlib, where the province of Idlib, where vast majority of Islamic State fighters and other jihadi derivatives are located. The Russians and the Syrians want to assert control over that large piece. It's like to be likely going to be bloody. It's going to create an even greater refugee flow. But Syria is now the purview of quote unquote outside powers: the Turks, the Iranians, the Russians. And, of course, the Assad regime allied with two of the three. The Americans have never identified Syria as a vital national interest and as a consequence, can't compete with those who do.
Very good. Aaron David Miller, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks for joining us.